It says we're recording, so...
Let's see if my microphone is functioning okay.
My microphone is functioning nice, so I can
hear. There we are. Well, there we go.
So the way we start this is I say that this is the 12th of December, 2003. I'm on the campus of the University of Ottawa and interviewing Professor John Holmes, who is the emeritus, I think, here.
Yeah.
And who has an illustrious career in thermochemistry and mass spectrometry. And I think that's enough to get us started. And what I like to do, particularly for people who have these very good scientific careers, is find out information about their early childhood and the attitude of their parents toward education, and how, if this was encouraged them in their education, or what influences led to their becoming a well-educated person. So, you were born in the UK, I believe.
I was born in Cricklewood, which is North London. Exactly as it sounds, C-R-I-C-K-L-E, C-R-I-C-K-L-E, W-O-O-D, Cricklewood. It's about 4 miles north of Marble Arch, so it's not far from central London by present-day standards, but when when the house was built, it was a suburb. The house was built in 1900, and so Cricklewood was getting on towards the sticks then.
Now it's in the middle of the city, probably.
Yes, there's another 15 miles to go.
And you were born in 1931. Okay. And your parents, their names?
My mother is Jessie Ethel, and my father is Leonard Thomas.
Okay.
Her maiden name was Doble, D-O-B-L-E.
Okay. And what were their professions?
My father worked in local government it would have been the Department of Health then, for the district known as Willesden. W-I-L-L-E-S-D-E-N, Willesden.
Okay.
Yes, and mother, of course, when mother and father got married, my mother had to give up work because married women were not allowed to work.
Mm-hmm.
So sometime after the war, I remember my mother was very keen that Dad should quit his job and they should start a business. And I think they would have been a great success. Because of mother's drive. And father was fiscally very conservative, and he was not prepared to take the risk. And so, life continued as usual, and he retired at 65 from local government. But I think they would have made a very good commercial team.
Did your mother have a job prior to getting married?
Yes, she worked in a variety of secretarial posts. Was with the Canadian YMCA, by strange coincidence, during the First World War. When there were a lot of Canadian troops, and they had quite a big organization in London.
So, what about her education?
She went to a very good North London high school called Maida Vale, Maida Vale School for Girls, Maida Vale, M-A-I-D-A, Maida Vale, V-A-L-E. That's a district of North London as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good girls' school. I visited it from my own school when they first introduced inter-school dances for the sixth formers. And so one of these complicated school interactions. But I've still got postcards which were made of all the facilities at my mother's school, and it was, for its time, was astonishingly well equipped with art classrooms, chemical laboratory, physics, the whole bit. So she went through to as far as matriculation, which would be high school graduation in those days, 1900 and gosh, I guess about 1914, maybe 15.
Okay. And this, your father's education would have been more formal, or?
My father's father ran away from home when he was quite small, and I can't say that I'm surprised, because my paternal grandmother was a lady of whom I was frightened as a little boy. So Dad was sent out to work as an office boy as soon as he was old enough. It was, they had a rather straitened family life.
Yes, so now they get this straight. It was your grandfather that ran away from home?
That's right, it's my grandfather on my father's side.
Okay.
My grandfather on my mother's side was a very successful businessman. He was director of a company in the West End, which still exists. It was called the Pall Mall Safety Deposit and Forwarding Company, and their business was in looking after the effects of really people in the empire and businessmen. So if a family was suddenly sent off to do its empire duty in India, they would deposit all their valuables with this firm that my grandfather ran. It was also a travel agency as well, so a lot of travel could be arranged. They were responsible for the shipping of all the goods of the Bolshoi Ballet when they started moving around in the, I guess, in the 40s, late 40s.
Wow. You say this company still exists?
Pardon me?
This company still exists today?
Yes, it does, yes, yes, but in a very reduced form. I think you can understand there wasn't a great deal of use for this kind of company during the war years, and so their capital decreased very greatly through the war, and then it started up again after the war, but there wasn't an empire then, and so there weren't huge numbers of people who wanted to leave all their jewelry and furs and precious belongings in a safe place.
So education was, let's finish with your father's education. Yeah. He went to college or?
No.
He did not?
Okay. No. He would have finished middle school, I guess.
Oh, okay.
So he went out to work. He was sent out to work when he was 14.
So let's see, your grandfather ran away from home and he sent his son out to work. At a young age?
No, it would have been, he had already left, and so my grandmother, my father's mother, would have sent him out to work at the earliest opportunity. And his sisters were also sent out to work at the earliest opportunity.
So this was a necessity for the family?
It was a necessity for the family, because that grandmother had to bring up a family with no father present.
And so she was a little bit of a imperious.
She was a tough lady.
Yeah,
she
well,
was.
She had a
yes.
Tough problem
yes.
To deal with
yes.
And
indeed. So.
Reacted toughly.
Yeah.
So the education then was primarily your mother was.
Yes.
More formal education than your father.
Yes.
And. There was obviously an attitude towards education in your family growing up that I would assume encouraged you to do something on the intellectual or develop your intellectual interests.
Yes.
And your mother,
yes.
Father,
yes. Both of them were educationally enthusiastic.
So that encouraged you in reading and
yes.
Providing
yes.
Material for you.
Yes. Yes, I had a lot of books as a kid.
Mm-hmm. This was probably in the late 30s, early 40s, then, when you were dealing with a lot of its influence.
I started reading very early because my parents sent me to a convent school first off. They were not Catholic, but they knew of this convent school where everybody who came out after a fairly short period could do reading, writing and arithmetic. And absolutely right. I came away from that school after probably about a year, and I could write reasonably, and I could read, and I could do my sums. But the nuns were very kind, but very firm. And I'm afraid the religion that they imparted to me took a very long time to get out from under.
Did they wrap any knuckles with rulers?
Yes, they did. Yes, they had short ruler, and they would whack you on the back of the knuckles if you were writing. That's dreadful, John. Whack.
Never mind. It's interesting. The difference in talking to different people from this era.
Yes, now, yes.
Corporal punishment. Yes, was yes, dealt, yes. That was dealt with or dead, performed, and today would, people would get put under jail.
Well, at the schools that came after the cane was a normal, formal mm-hmm. punishment. Not very often. Mm-hmm. You had to do something pretty bad to get caned. But I think it was more... A great deal of discipline was verbal mm-hmm. by a carefully contrived put-down. Mm-hmm. Which would obviously reduce a stroppy small boy to silence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, psychology as well.
Yes, yes, yes.
So, but you just went to this school for 1 year?
Just for one year.
And, your skill set.
And then I went to a prep school. It was called a prep school called Westcroft.
So that would have been, when you say a prep school, what does that mean? To Americans,
in the 1930s, there had not been the 1944 Education Act, mm-hmm. and so one's way through the education system largely had to be paid for. So I was sent to a prep school, mm-hmm. Which is a kind of preschool to a public school.
Okay.
And I was sent to the prep school, which was very good, a small school mm-hmm. run by three maiden ladies. I suspect they were maiden because their husbands were killed in, or boyfriends were killed in WW1. And so, but they were very good, and they taught a wide range of subjects, so you went to there from the age of about 5 to 9 or 10.
Okay. So
a small school.
So in America today, a prep school is considered to be a high school that prepares kids for college. But in this case, it's
preparing kids for secondary education. Okay. Yes.
So the this was the three women basically covered the turf for...
That's right. They were... two of them had been associated with Haberdashers, which was the public school, mm-hmm. and they set up the school as their own concern, and they made a very good job of it.
This was private, so...
This was private school.
Paid for, and there was fairly small class size. That was...
That's right. We were probably, I don't know, maybe not more than 15 in a class.
Okay. So this was, what were the other options for your education if your parents hadn't sent you to the prep school?
To a state school, okay. To a state school, of which there were quite a few in the neighborhood.
Okay. But for some reason or other, your parents wanted you to go to this prep school, which was probably better, you would say?
Yes, undoubtedly, because it was the class sizes were small. And the aim of the whole exercise was to get these kids into the nearby public school, Haberdashers, which still is quite a good school, except now it is ludicrously expensive. I've visited from time to time to see what's happened to the old school.
Is that a Haberdashers is another private school?
Yeah, it was founded maybe in the 1700s. Oh, wow. It was called Haberdashers Asks Hampstead School, and it was founded by a guy called Robert Ask, who was a haberdasher.
Okay.
And haberdashery had a guild, so mm-hmm. in a way it was connected with a guild school.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And something with a very long history as well.
Yes,
did you
yes.
get exposed to that history as a student?
No, not at all. Oddly enough, the history of the school has only recently been written by a man called John Wigley, and I asked him what the boys called him, and he wouldn't tell me. I mean, with a name like Wigley. Yes. Anyway, he wrote the school history sometime in the last 10 years.
Interesting. Do you remember the name of any of those ladies that taught you in your prep school?
Yes, the senior lady was a Miss Challen, Challen.
Uh-huh.
The second in command was a Miss Biggs, Biggs.
Mm-hmm.
And the third was a Miss Alderton, much younger than the other two, Alderton. Miss Alderton was, from this distant vantage point, probably quite an attractive woman.
Mm-hmm.
And the other two dressed in tweeds mm-hmm. and were very severe.
Mm-hmm. And you suspect that most of these were basically widows from World War
II? Well, not widows, but neither of them had been married,
mm-hmm.
but I suspect that their fiancés had been killed.
Okay. So somewhere along the way, your interest began to become developed in science, chemistry, physics, math.
In going to haberdashers.
Mm-hmm.
When I went, I had to intersperse a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Because in 1939 the hostilities began,
mm-hmm.
and we were all evacuated from Westcroft.
Mm-hmm.
We were evacuated to the West Country, to Somerset, to an old country house,
mm-hmm.
Which had belonged to, who did it belong to? There was a connection with Clive of India, anyway, it was a large old country house near Yeovil, Yeovil. I could tell you the name of the country house if you need it, but we were all evacuated there as a school. The whole lot of us got on a coach,
mm-hmm.
and on the day war was declared, we were off down into Somerset.
Okay. This was to get away from the big city.
Well, yes, because millions of children were moved
mm-hmm.
In 1939,
mm-hmm.
and because nothing happened in 1939, it wasn't all over by Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, bugger all happened before Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of these evacuation schemes appeared to be unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember from being down in the country, parents would come down to see how we were living, which was, let's say, rather simply. And they moved their kids back to London. So by early 1940, I was back in London with my parents,
mm-hmm.
and the school struggled on down in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So schooling was haphazard for the rest of 1940.
Mm-hmm.
And then the evacuation was considered a failure, and the school came back to Cricklewood.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had about another 6 months of Westcroft before I moved on to haberdashers.
I see. So the first impact of the war was this World War II, was this 39 evacuation.
That's right. Yeah.
And you say there was some sense that everything would be over by Christmas.
That was the popular gossip that the war would be over by Christmas. Nobody took it very seriously in terms of being a long war. And then, of course, 1940, everything went to hell in a handcart. And France fell, and the Low Countries, Norway, Denmark, and the Blitz started at the Battle of Britain was September 40. And then the Blitz started almost immediately after that.
So you had to live through that.
So yeah, I was in. I spent the war in London.
So there was no more evacuation.
No more evacuation.
So what experience from that? Other experiences from the war? Do you recall?
Yeah, we had a. My grandfather paid to have a brick and concrete small air raid shelter built in a back garden. We spent a lot of uncomfortable nights sitting in there listening to. You could tell if it was ours or theirs by the beat of the engine.
Oh, really?
The German aircraft engines were slightly detuned to give them a beat.
No.
Because that interfered with audio direction and distance finding. And so you knew it was one of theirs because the engine had a beat. If it was one of ours, it was a continuous, unbroken whine. Sounds. Yes.
Very interesting. These are the little strange things that you.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, and they open. And of course, at the beginning of the Blitz, there was not much of an anti-aircraft barrage, which, although it was totally ineffectual anyway, was very good for morale. But by the time the Blitz got going towards at the end of October, there were guns everywhere in the park, down the road, and where you had a big intersection of roads with big clear space in the middle, they would often bring a mobile anti-aircraft gun and establish it in the middle. And so the Blitz was very noisy, but you felt that something was being done to protect you, even though we now know that it was not a lot of use.
Well, maybe it had an effect on the German aviators, who knows?
it might have done, but I'm not sure they needed to take it very seriously.
So how frequently did you have to undergo this Blitz attack?
We had about, I think it 90 days on the trot, or 90 nights, about 3 months every night.
Oh, God.
And I remember in the early days of the Blitz, one night we came out of the shelter because the all clear had sounded.
Sure.
And my father said, look, we can read a newspaper in the garden. And that's quite true, we could. And those were the fires in Dockland, making a sufficient reflected light that you could read out of doors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that destruction. Was your property, the property of your parents, affected at all by...
Luckily, no. Nothing worse than the occasional tiles dislodged from the roof by shrapnel. Shrapnel was something you, as a schoolboy, you went out looking for every morning.
I see.
Must there be these gleaming pieces of metal in the road?
Yes. Was your schooling? Did the school routine change significantly because of the Blitz?
No, because it was nearly all night bombing,
okay.
and the school routine was only disturbed. When the V2s, V1s and V2s started.
Okay.
When the doodlebug started, the V1, of course they were often daytime events, and so we spent a lot of time sitting on cement blocks in a miserable air raid shelter at school.
Oh my. That must have been a pretty depressing thing to have to go through.
No, it wasn't depressing. It was interesting.
Interesting.
And I don't think anybody was afraid. Anxious, yes, because when you sat in the air raid shelter at school and you listened and you could hear, oh shit, there's one of those, there's a doodle bug coming, and you would hear the note rising. Mm-hmm. You think, yes, it's getting nearer, it's getting nearer, it's getting nearer. I don't want it to cut out while the sound is still increasing. I want the Doppler effect to tell me it's passed. And so you'd sit there listening carefully, and when the beat went through its maximum, you thought, okay, it can cut out now. It won't be falling on us.
And fall on somebody else.
Yeah, that's right. And so there'll be that, though the engine note would just suddenly cease. Mm. And then you'd wait about 10 seconds, and then boom, some.
Well, I mean, people were killed during these...
Yeah, a very large number, yes, yes.
A lot of destruction of property.
You'd see that every day. When I went to school by train, you could see property damage from the train. On an elevated section, you could see, oh, there's a big gap over there. It used to be two houses there.
Would they... Do you know if there's any targeted approach to industrial parts of the city, or would they just...
Well, I'm sure there was, but you probably know that aerial bombing then, you were lucky if you got a bomb within a mile of your intended target.
Yeah.
And that cut both ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, the story I got is that radar is what was a savior.
In the Battle of Britain, yes. Yes, yeah. Because it picked up the aircraft in plenty of time. Yeah, they had those. Right. They had those big towers along the south coast. Yeah.
Well, that was must have been. So this lasted 90 days. And did it continue at a lesser pace?
No. He. Why did Hitler discontinue the Blitz? I think really because he was thinking of the assault on Russia. The invasion of the UK went onto the bottom, onto the back burner, and the planned assault on Russia was the, of course, 1941. Wow, away we go. And so the air raids diminished greatly until the V weapons, and then what was that, 44 and 45. The rockets were absolute pain because you couldn't hear them coming. In fact, you heard them coming afterwards because they came in supersonic speeds, and so you heard a hell of a bang, and then the noise of it arriving would come afterwards.
Bad stuff.
Yeah, very, very arbitrary. They were not aimed at anything in particular, they were just a general London area, and so they fell anywhere.
So I think there was an attempt to demoralize the English citizens on the part of Germany.
It was too little and too late.
Yeah, but that was, I think, the idea, because it was pretty much...
Yes, that's right, that's right.
So during this period, you're developing an interest in science?
Yep,
okay.
Yes.
By the way, I'm just curious if you recall, had any idea what your parents were paying for this private education?
I got a scholarship.
Ah, okay.
I got a scholarship. Because this, I knew this was happening, I better fill in a quick bit. You don't need to record this. A few years ago, my daughter asked me to write my life story.
Oh, very good.
And... So I remembered a lot of things and filled in all the details and added extras as they came along.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's probably why I remember quite a lot about the Blitz.
Mm-hmm.
And also the beginning of interest in science.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember the first practical experiment I ever did, which was separating a mixture of salt and sand.
Okay.
And you dissolved the salt in water and filtered off, dried the sand and weighed it and evaporated the liquid and produced your sample of salt. I suppose I was, what, maybe 10 when that started.
Was this something that you did as a... personal experience?
Yes, all the kids in the class did it. We had a science teacher called Mr. Henwood, who was known as Chickweed. Most masters collected nicknames in school.
So, but you definitely didn't call him Chickweed.
No. That was amongst ourselves. He was a good science teacher, general science. Mm-hmm. So you got a little bit of general physics and general chemistry and stuff from him. Chemistry seriously didn't begin until the third form, when I would have been about 12. Mm-hmm. And then we started doing real hands-on chemistry, and it seemed fantastic. All those colours, mm-hmm. coloured flames, mm-hmm. coloured precipitates, which did or did not dissolve. We did a traditional analytical chemistry with the Kipps generator of H2S in the fume hood, mm-hmm. and we made things. We made samples ourselves. Well, remember, we made pyrophoric iron by reducing Fe3O4 in a stream of coal gas, and we had little boats in a hard glass tube. And coal gas was streamed over them and ignited at the end, of course. Mm-hmm. And the little boats in the hard glass tube were heated to red heat. And the ferric oxide was reduced to iron. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, we took a glass blowing torch and sealed off one for keeps. Mm-hmm. And the other one we were allowed to take out into the air. And you shook the little dish, and of course it spontaneously ignited in air. Wow, yes, great.
So this was fine iron filings.
This is Fe, no, it's Fe3O4, ferric oxide, as a powder, reduced to pyrophoric iron metal. And so, yeah, it spontaneously ignited all right.
So these types of things captured your interest.
Oh, it's marvelous. Yes.
So it's not like a true alchemist at heart.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yes. Yes.
You weren't one of these individuals at this era that had their own chemistry set.
I had a chemistry set at home. No strong acids or bases, but a lot of salts. Mm-hmm. And because it was wartime, the home manufacture of gunpowder was something that everybody did.
I think every chemistry set has been used somehow or another to manufacture.
Yes, 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 yeah, yes.
By everyone who's ever had one. Yes. It's interesting. There is a collection of chemistry sets at the Chemical Heritage Foundation.
Oh, is there now? Oh, gosh. It'd be wonderful. Yes, yes.
Of course, now they've been so emasculated that no one...
it's not really a chemistry set at all. No, in those days you could go into a pharmacist, mm-hmm. a chemist shop, mm-hmm. and you could buy sodium metal.
Oh wow!
And it was stored in the chemist shop under toluene, and you could go in and ask for a gram, and as a boy, and they would sell you a gram in a little hard glass tube with toluene. And so you could take it away. And one of the things which caused punishments in the classroom was one kid brought in a small sample of sodium, which he cut up on his desk. And we all had inkwells which contained liquid ink. And so he dropped the pieces of sodium in the inkwell, and boom. This was in the little in-between before teacher arrived, and there were still two desks with sodium flames. So yeah, the culprit had to go and see the headmaster.
I bet.
But it was the ease of getting chemicals then that was so extraordinary. God knows what you'd have to do now.
Certainly, be reported to some authority.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh my! It's just a sampling of how times have changed. That you can't. So many things you cannot do today.
Yes, I know. I know.
I think Frank Field had the same experience that he would supplement his chemistry set by going to a chemical supply
house, that's right.
Whatever he wanted.
That's right.
Did you ever have the disastrous experiment personally where something went wrong and you got more than you bargained for?
No. A complete side issue. I was asked quite a few years ago, as a result of something that happened here, to make a little compendium of chemical accidents that I had known or experienced. Mm-hmm. And when I got to the end, my opinion was that nearly all of them were true accidents. They were not a result of foolishness, carelessness, or larking about. Mm-hmm. They were things that happened. It was an accident. Mm-hmm. It would not have been foreseen. Mm-hmm. And most of them fell in that category.
And you didn't have to experience any of those personally in your early chemistry experiments?
No. I knew one fellow later in life who lost his hand, mm-hmm. Lost his left hand through a gunpowder and schoolboy mm-hmm. experience.
Well, that's not good. So, excuse me, you really have it seems like an enthusiasm for chemistry now.
Yeah.
This would have been around in your early teens.
Yes.
So you're really kind of committed at this point to pursue chemistry?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did you have any friends who were likewise committed, or were you just...
Yes, I had a close friend who I still see. Mm. He became a chemical engineer.
Okay.
And we did experiments together. And we often did experiments in physics. Mm. I won't bother you with the details. There's a thing you could make called a Fehling's coherer. A Fehling's coherer was a means of picking up electromagnetic radiation. Mm-hmm. So it was a communication device. Mm-hmm. It was a curiosity of, I presume, the early part of the century. Mm-hmm. And you could read about it. So I remember Ken saying, let's see if we can make a pair of Fehling's coherers so we could communicate between mm-hmm. our houses. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get the damn things to operate over more than about 200 yards.
Oh, so, wow, that's a pretty good distance.
But it was...
Ken
Pierce is his name. He lives in northern England now.
So, but you still...
We still travel together,
oh,
yeah.
That's good. Well, your scholarship paid for your early education, and you're still in essentially what we would call in America as a high school.
Yes.
And that was paid for through scholarship up until you were able to go on to college.
No, I didn't go on to college.
Ah, okay.
Because in the sixth form, which is... I should explain, there were two levels of exam in the UK.
Okay.
There was a general school certificate, which you took when you were about 15, mm-hmm. which was, if you did well in it, you could go on to the sixth form and study for higher schools, which was essentially university mm-hmm. entry, or you could take your general school's results and if they were good, they would get you a good job in industry, government, wherever. Anyway, I went into the sixth form, and I'm afraid I messed about for 2 years. I didn't work very hard at all. And so I ended up with just a pass in chemistry at higher schools, And so, sorry about all this, you're going to have to get a job. And I knew of a friend down our road. We had moved into further out of from central London then, that quite a good job was being a trainee analytical chemist at Glaxo, the pharmaceutical company. And then in 1948, Glaxo was quite a small company, and they were just beginning to make their name with penicillin and streptomycin, which then were pretty new and exciting. And so I went to become a trainee analytical chemist at Glaxo at Greenford. That was their main research and development and production facility in the London area.
Greenford,
exactly the way it sounds. And so I was there, and in again, in those enlightened days, industry, by law, had to allow trainees one day a week for study and to pursue their education. So I took my day release, so I had one day and an evening at Acton Technical College and two other evenings. So it was three evenings and one day a week at Acton Technical College, which, looking back at it, was extremely good, even though it was only a tech.
You were what age by this?
1948, so I was 17, just 17. So I started at Glaxo and took the day release and went to Acton Tech one day and three evenings, and got my intermediate BSc the next year. And then there was another hurdle. There was a maths hurdle to jump intermediate mathematics on the way to the degree. And after 4 years at Glaxo, I decided I would leave Glaxo and spend the whole year at Acton Tech for finals. And now Glaxo had a jolly good bonus scheme then. You got a quarterly bonus, which could be as much as 30% of what you'd earned in that quarter. So this all went into a savings account.
So the bonus was based on the performance of the company?
Of the company, as a whole. And every employee got a bonus, so wow. Anyway, so I stashed all this in a post office savings account and quit Glaxo. And I got another studentship, and with my bonus money, and obviously help from my parents, I did a year's full-time study at Acton Tech, and then took the London External BSc. Now, in those days, London University ran an external BSc program, and I can put it in perspective for you, because anybody in any of the technical colleges in the UK could sit the London External BSc in chemistry and in physics and maths and so on. And the year I sat, 750 people took the finals exam. There were five firsts, and there were 52 seconds and 180 or so passes. And I got a second, and that was good enough to get me in as a graduate student at University College London. And that was a very good decision.
Yeah. So that when you say BSE,
bachelor's degree.
The E doesn't mean anything in the BSE. It just says bachelor's of science.
Bachelor of science. Yes, okay. It's a first degree.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you got a little more serious about your study.
Yes. And I enjoyed my time at Glaxo because after quite a long period doing routine analytical chemistry, from which you learned a huge amount, they moved me into the analytical research lab, where their responsibility was to devise new analytical methods for their new products and for anything else which turned up. And that was astonishingly interesting. There were only three of us in the lab, and we had a go at just about anything.
So most of your experience initially was wet chemical.
Wet chemistry.
And do you recall much about the kinds of things that you were analyzing?
Yes, vitamin. All synthetic intermediates from the pilot plant. Final products of pharmaceuticals. There was biological assay of penicillin, which was a terribly boring thing to do. But anyway, biological assay of penicillin. And often samples would come from the hospital. You would get nasty-looking samples of sputum from Harrow Hospital for penicillin assay analysis. So you gloved up appropriately and prepared the sample for biological assay.
Yeah. And if the penicillin worked against that particular thing, it would also
tell the medical practitioner whether there was any penicillin left in the fluids of the victim. It was fairly crude then. You know that the ordinary penicillin G, is a sodium salt, hydrolyzes very quickly. Its life in solution is bloody awful. And so they wanted to make derivatives of penicillin, which would be longer lasting, more stable. And the neat idea they came up with was procaine penicillin. Of course, procaine is also an anesthetic.
Yes.
And so procaine penicillin, the idea was, could be squirted into people in large quantities, which normally would be extremely painful. But as the procaine hydrolyzed off, the pain was greatly diminished. Now, nasty thinking back at it, procaine penicillin was used pharmaceutically as a suspension in arachis oil.
What?
Arachis oil, it's a cooking oil.
Oh, no.
A-R-A-C-H-I-S, arachis oil.
Hmm.
Anyway, so the suspension of this white solid in this oil was what was squirted into a muscle. And since the quantities were several mils, the procaine was really needed. The idea was that it was slowly dissipated, of course, from the muscle, from an oil suspension. Anyway, that was nasty.
When you went into this elite kind of research group, what kind of instrumentation were you using? Were you using instrumentation then, or was it
the only instrumentation we had were spectrophotometers and a polarimeter. Infrared was a research only machine that was over in another building. Of course, mass spectrometry didn't exist then. Infrared was new, NMR had not been heard of, and so a great deal was UV and visible spectrophotometry, making coloured derivatives for analytical purposes. Great way to go if you've just got UV and visible spectral equipment.
So you actually just worked 4 days a week and then had a week.
And had a day off to go to Acton Tech.
Now, was this, you mentioned at one point this Education Act of 1944. It sounds like
that was a big move, because it said the school leaving age is raised to 15
instead of 14. Okay.
And every child who qualifies is guaranteed secondary education.
Okay.
At no cost. So there was a huge expansion in education, and unlike today, education was regarded as a good thing. In the UK, the working class does not seem to have does not have that impetus for educating its kids anymore. But then it was huge, and so there was a great surge of people advancing education.
And so you definitely qualified to continue your education. Now, this you eventually were you paying for your the technical education
at Acton Tech? No, no, no. Your employer paid that.
Ah, okay.
Yep, that was also a fiat.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. But they could see, if you didn't pass the exams, they could say, hey, Joe, we're not going to support you for another year, or we'll give you one more term and you'd better bloody pass, or we'll withdraw the privilege.
But once you quit Glaxo, then you had to pay your way, and you had prepared for that by getting together.
For the year at Acton Tech, yes. Yeah.
And you then decided to pursue chemistry there exclusively, or what? I know the educational system is, you kind of tend to focus a little bit more on a specialty, don't you?
Well, it was an honors chemistry degree then, it was chemistry, and with ancillary mathematics, you took quite a lot of calculus, but physics had dropped off from the curriculum then.
And there were no, quote, humanities, liberal arts, or any of those
things. No.
So coming in with the second, that gave you the opportunity to move on to graduate school.
Yeah.
Okay. And you have a choice of schools, or?
You could apply anywhere.
Okay. Did you explore?
I visited King's College, London, University College, and Queen Mary College. I'm not sure if I went to Imperial or not. I don't know. But anyway, it was obvious that University College was where it was at, because Christopher Ingold was the chair, and he became Sir Christopher Ingold. Ingold, yes, okay. Christopher. Mm-hmm. His son, by the way, lives in Ottawa. He's also a scientist, Keith. Anyway, Ingold ran a department which was really second to none. It was probably the best department in the country. I didn't know that, but the impression it made on me was striking. I went there for interview. And a very nice Welshman called Ted Hughes, H-U-G-H-E-S. Hughes and Ingold were names that you coupled together, like Marks and Spencer. And Ted Hughes interviewed me, and he had a nice sing-song Welsh voice. And he said, I think we should be able to accommodate you if you get a good degree. And so I went up and said, in effect, here I am. I'd like to do grad studies here. And I was placed by him with Alan McColl.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting. An old relationship that goes for years.
Yeah, that's right.
So when you say you interviewed, who interviewed who?
Ted Hughes interviewed me. Interviewed me. I applied. He said, come and have an interview. And so we had a jolly chat, and he said, what would you like to do? And I said, we talked chemistry. And he said, okay. He said, you're accepted. I will write to you shortly and name your supervisor.
Okay.
So I didn't know Alan at all, and so a letter duly came and said, yes, your supervisor will be Alan McColl. So rush off to University College and introduce myself to Alan.
Right. Very good. Beginning of a long, long, long relationship. Yes. So how long did it take for you to complete your studies there?
I did 3 years, 3 years PhD. The norm was 3 years.
Yeah. And obviously you've got to, pick a topic to burrow in on and specialize on for that work.
Alan's main interest then was thermal decomposition.
Okay.
And so he had done, the foundation studies of the thermal decomposition of halogenated organics.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of the exercise in doing these kinetic studies was to try to find a correlation between a physical property of a series of molecules and their rates of thermal decomposition.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for example, all the alkyl halides dissociate by loss of HX, the halogen acid. And in the case of the chlorides, it's a molecular reaction. In the case of the bromides, it's a free radical and molecular reaction. In the case of the iodides, which I got, they lose HI first, and then the hydrogen iodide reacts very smartly with the iodide to produce iodine. So you get an alkane, an alkene, and iodine from the thermal decomposition. So that was my project, to do alkyl iodides.
Well, these halogenated compounds are not a lot of fun to work with. I mean, they can be nasty, can't they?
HF is extremely nasty. But we made all our own compounds. I did experiments with nitric oxide, and making pure nitric oxide is quite a challenge. So anyway, that was a great prep, that, because you knew it was pure when it was a white crystal at liquid nitrogen temperatures. If it had any NO2 in it, it was blue or pale blue. So more trap-to-trap distillations were required to get pure NO.
Really, process that you were the work was really synthetic in wet chemistry and biology.
Well, a lot of making of compounds, yes, but the reactions were all gas phase thermal decompositions.
Okay.
It was all pyrolysis.
And were you using any analytical equipment in a modern sense in this exercise?
Conventional analytical chemistry, the mass balance had to be found by titrating the halogen acid, correlating that with the pressure change, and it was conventional chemistry.
Oh boy, that's quite challenging. Well,
it wasn't really, because it was all you knew, you see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If and certainly with the background at Glaxo.
Mm-hmm.
I regarded analytical chemistry as a conventional analytical chemistry as a very powerful tool.
Oh, yeah.
Even though it was time consuming and full of technical difficulties.
Yes. Were people specializing in analytical chemistry during this period as a
research topic? No.
No.
No, no, it was developed in industry almost entirely. And, certainly the pharmaceutical industries desperately needed analytical chemistry, because it was their only way to go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But, for instance, in this synthesis and study, you also had to be your own analytical chemist.
Yes.
So it was a skill that just about every... or a synthetic chemist had to really have some mastery.
That's right.
Do this dirty work for him, because how did you prove what you had done?
Well, what I found was that the students who had gone through the in-house degree system at University College did not have half the practical skills that I had. So although they had a much better theoretical foundation, in practical terms, they weren't very experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So my time at Glaxo served me well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's good. And the idea that they furthered your education as you worked there. It's also it paid off. It's a a governmental mandate that came to fruition.
Yes.
How many other people probably benefited from that? I mean, there must have been many people benefited by that enlightened attitude. Free education every
well, if you think in that particular year, 750 people in the UK took the external degree exams, that's quite a lot of people aged about 20, 22, who had all been supported one way or another. Through a release scheme,
So you actually now have a degree, a PhD degree, and you are getting ready to look for a job.
There were two problems. One was where to go, of course, and the other one was how not to have to do national service. Because 2 years of national service were still awaiting. Before you're 26, you had to do 2 years of national service.
And when you graduated with your degree, you were...
I was 24.
You were older than most of the...
That's with my PhD, yes.
Okay. So these two problems had to be dealt with. How did you do that?
The normal way to avoid... I'm afraid spending two really useless years in the army was to get a reserved occupation job, which meant working for the Atomic Energy Authority, any of their multiple branches, munitions or weaponry, rocket research, what else was, research institutes of nationalized industry. And so I went to the Radiochemical Center, which is also in North London, to think about a job there. And I interviewed for the National Coal Board to do research in coal. And to cut a long story short, and because of happenstance, I went to the National Coal Board. And so I worked out my time, which in this instance was 1 year, at the National Coal Board Research Establishment, which was way out in the countryside, near Cheltenham in Gloucestershire.
This was not your really first choice?
Well, my first choice was to take a postdoc in North America. But I had to do something about the national service thing because I was not yet 26. So I did a year at the Coal Board and then took a fellowship in Canada. That was thanks to Alan McColl, of course.
So the year satisfied your 2 year requirement, or you were 26?
No, you had to have done something of equivalence before you were 26.
Before 26.
Yeah.
So you were 26 after a year.
I was 26 after just over a year at Stoke Orchard.
So you were able to say goodbye, guys.
I'll say leave that. Yes, it was.
So what did you do at the Coal Board?
Do you remember a man called Jacob Bronowski? He was a television scientist. Yes, he produced a series which is still available and in book form as well, called The Ascent of Man.
I've heard of that.
Okay, well, that was Jacob Bronowski. And Jacob Bronowski was a man of many parts. And he was also director of the National Coal Board Coal Research Establishment, about which he knew remarkably little.
Yeah.
He was playwright as well, and he was in a poetry writing stint at the time. And he lived in a house way up in the hills, And every now and again he'd come down to Stoke Orchard and he'd sit in on scientific meetings. And there was no doubt he had a huge knowledge, but not necessarily organized the right way. And I can see him sitting at one of the little scientific group meetings where we discuss what was going on in the thermal decomposition of coal. And somebody, not me, but somebody was rattling on about free radical chemistry. Oh yes, said Bronowski, free radicals. And those are molecules that have lost electrons. And nobody batted an eyelid. we let it go. Just let it go. And there was a wonderful occasion when the Duke of Edinburgh came to Stoke Orchard on an inspection tour.
Oh,
and there was a process for turning useless coal into valuable coal. One of its names was called Nutty Slack. It was high in sulfur and solids, and it was pretty desperate stuff. They worked out a method of heating this coal in a fluid bed, driving off the nasty volatiles, and the residual charcoal could be compressed into briquettes. And the briquettes burnt quite nicely. The only trouble was they didn't stick together very well, but that was a secondary issue. Anyway, Bronowski came, the Duke of Edinburgh came, and one of the things he was going to be shown was the wonders of the briquetting process. And here's a fire with all these briquettes blazing away. Wonderful. And I learned afterwards that the briquettes had been made out of pure anthracite. It was, of course, a fudge. And it appeared in the newspapers with the Duke and Bronowski smiling at this fireplace. And I thought, yes, oh dear, yes. I'm afraid the process never made industrial grade. But it was a good idea. It was the right idea to get rid of the volatiles and produce a char, which was compressible into briquettes. But unfortunately, they didn't stick together properly.
So your specific activities there were?
My specific activity was the briquette, the fluid bed heating process. Gave rise, of course, to nasty vapors and a tar. And the tar was, a terrible aqueous mess. And it was homogeneous. And they said, well, we have no idea what to do with this stuff. Obviously, if it goes to industrial process, it's going to be thousands of gallons of this.
Yeah.
What can you do with it? So, your project, think about it and see what you can... Well, the first thing was to break the emulsion. And they had failed conspicuously by blowing steam through and doing other stuff. So I said, well, all you've got to do is to salt it out. You know how you salt out an emulsion? They said, well, you better demonstrate it. So I got the welder to build me a big steel can. And we heated the whole lot up and poured rock salt in, and lo and behold, the oil floated and the aqueous salt solution came out the bottom. Right, now then, what are the physical properties of the tar that remains? Yeah, well, that was the next problem as to what the hell to do with that, because it was too viscous to put on the roads or anything like that. And so I started on a project which involved, first of all, a very controlled thermal decomposition of the tar to see if useful compounds could be dragged out of it. And by then I had served my time.
You got to escape.
I got to escape, yes.
And your friend Alan arranged for you to get a postdoc.
Yeah, Stacy, who was president of the Research Council here in Ottawa, had visited University College when I was a student. And so he and Alan became quite good friends. So when I spoke to Alan, and Alan said, well, where would you like to go, in the States or Canada? So I said, well, I quite fancy Canada, because I understand there's a lot of winter sports in the Ottawa area. So he said, oh, he said, I could probably fix you up with Ned Stacy. So I duly got an offer from Stacy, and I came to Ottawa in 1958.
Oh, okay.
1958.
So you'd have been 27, late
20s. Yeah, I was 27 when I came here.
Okay. And this was an academic?
It was a postdoc. It was a postdoc at Sussex Drive, just up the road from where you are now. Mm-hmm. It was a fantastic, wonderful place.
Who did you work with for there?
I was nominally working for Stacy, but he was president, and so obviously he had lieutenants who looked after things, and the fellow I was assigned to was a man called Kutschke, K-U-T-S-C-H-K-E. His first name was Ken Kutschke.
K-K.
Yeah, K-K, K Kutschke.
Yeah.
And I did photochemistry.
Oh, okay.
And because nobody had done anything with aromatics, in chatting to Stacy, Stacy said, well, we haven't had any work done on free radical reactions involving aromatics. Why don't you have a go? So I looked at the reaction of trifluoromethyl radicals with aromatic substrates. And that was how I met Fred Lossing. Because Fred Lossing did analytical mass spectrometry as well as his energetic stuff.
No, he was he at the National
Research? Yeah, his lab was just down the corridor from me.
But he wasn't at the university, was he?
No, he was at NRC then. Okay. He'd been at the Research Council for quite a long time.
Okay, so you developed a relationship with Lossing at that time?
No, because in fact, I thought mass spectrometry was a broken tool. The reason was this: he had an analytical mass spectrometer which was entirely worked by hand, and the intensity of the peak was measured by the deflection of an ammeter. And he had a gal, Bernice, who ran this facility. Meanwhile, Fred was busy working up new ways of determining ionization energies and appearance energies. Well, anyway, you took your samples along to Bernice with an old glass system and a brake seal, magnetic brake seal, and you'd go along in a day or two to see what the results were. And I had been giving her, strongly believed, a diet, admittedly very dilute, of aromatic compounds in, well, if you like, residual air, and whatever else you could pump away from a liquid nitrogen cooled sample. And almost every time they came back, CO2 and water, we couldn't find any organic compounds. Another one, CO2 and water. And I used to get so frustrated. What the hell's going on? I'm bringing you compounds, for Pete's sake. Why can't you find? I guess they weren't volatile enough, or the apparatus, being homemade, wasn't very sensitive. So I regarded mass spectrometry as a pretty flawed subject. And so I didn't really get to know Fred then.
It didn't give me the answer I wanted.
That's right. It didn't give me any answer at all. So I thought, gee, this is a waste of time. So it was quite funny looking back at it, because we're all in the same boat. We'd often take samples down to Bernice, and the chances were she'd say, yes, there's a trace of C2F6, I think, and nothing else. It was.
So this was part of a routine arrangement that you were to take people who were doing these work for the university work, take samples over to Bernice to have them analyzed.
The people in the photochemistry division, the photochemistry division was here, and Fred Lossing's lab was there, and it was a standing arrangement that if the photochemical people had something which possibly could be analyzed by mass spectrometry, we had free run. We could take a sample down and say, could you please tell us if we've got any whatever in this?
Do you recall what the vapor pressure might have been of this compound that you were trying to get her to find?
I was hoping it was trifluorotoluene, but that would have been a liquid, but the quantities, by the way, of course, would have been very small. They would have been micromoles. Mm-hmm. So it was not exactly a sample.
Yeah.
It was a very small quantity from
yes. In retrospect, the fact that you didn't see much probably is...
It's not surprising. No, it wasn't. The apparatus wasn't sensitive enough, and we hadn't developed a technique for a better technique for introducing samples.
Yes, the vapor pressure is important.
All
right, now you're doing your postdoc. Here.
Two years at NRC.
Okay, and this was... So this was it NRC, or they paid for it, or you at the University of Ottawa?
No, at the University of... I didn't know anything about the University of Ottawa then.
Okay.
The NRC was a, was a postdoctoral fellowship, which in those ridiculous days was tax-free. Incredible. So governmental, isn't it? Listen, they were tax-free. The government said, this is not right. We can't have people coming here and getting fellowships which are tax-free. Raise the fellowships to the tune of the income tax and take it off them again. They'll have to complete a tax form. So that happened after I left. And I thought, oh, God, government. So the question was what to do. And...
they give you the money to
give it back to them. That's right. That's right.
That's good.
So there was. Why did I come back? I quite wanted to stay in North America, but I thought I should give academic life in the UK a shot. So I went to the University of Edinburgh.
The idea that you were going to do academic was pretty much cut and dried. You had enough experience.
Yeah, because chemistry is such fun.
No.
I didn't want to be told what to do. I wanted to do my own thing.
Okay, so yes. Academic is the way to go.
Yes, okay. So I got a fellowship and then a lectureship at the University of Edinburgh, which was a cure. It was very, very frustrating in Edinburgh. Really was.
So you're on the pole of the system.
It certainly worked like that. And I remember the second summer I was there, I had a really nice project going, and there were little grants that you could get so you could support a summer student. And I remember I thought, this is a bloody good proposal for a summer student. And it was only a small sum of money, £50 or something like that.
Yes.
And I didn't get it. And I thought, oh, shit, this is really awful.
Mm.
And...
do you have any idea why it wasn't funded?
Knowing Edinburgh, I'm quite sure there was a pecking order. The chair of the department was Sir Edmund Hurst. To get to see Sir Edmund, you had to jump a number of hurdles, especially his secretary, a formidable Scottish lady, who guarded everything and made sure you didn't see anybody. She was a real real. Anyway, about this time, they got a new chair of physical chemistry. You probably never came across a book. There was a book in the 1950s, I guess, or around 1960, that The Strength of Chemical Bonds was. It was a very good book. It was written by a man called Tom Cottrell. Two T's and two L's. And Tom Cottrell had been working for ICI in their explosives division on the west coast of Scotland. Mm-hmm. And the story went, told by Tom at any rate, that he'd been sitting on a tram in London one day and he saw that the chair of physical chemistry in his old alma mater was up for grabs, so he applied for it and got it. And so I came to know Tom Cottrell quite well. He was an interesting man. He became, this is parenthetic if you like, he became principal at the University of Stirling, which is a new university on the west coast of Scotland. And Tom was somebody who kept his emotions totally bottled. And once in a blue moon, there would be a terrible explosion of fury. And so I knew that Tom was internally like this. And while he was at Stirling, it was a troubled time student-wise. They had a visit from the Queen, and some students threw eggs at the Queen. And Tom was principal, and he took this as, you might expect, extremely badly. He had a heart attack and died. He was a nice guy, Tom Cottrell. I sailed with him. He raced a boat on the Firth of Forth.
So the chair position that he took was at the University of Stirling?
No, at the University of Edinburgh. He came to Edinburgh. And he was my one support, if you like, amongst the hierarchy.
So of all the people there, he was kindly disposed towards.
Yes. But the... what can I say? The pecking order at Edinburgh was clearly defined. And Edinburgh in those days was rife with class. It's something you won't be familiar with, but everybody had their place. And as an example, if you were an academic in Edinburgh and you had a child, one of the things you did was to put his name down, or her name down, at birth in one of the public schools in Edinburgh. Fee-paying, expensive, but status. And so the whole atmosphere of the place was like this.
This was in the 50s?
In the early 60s.
Early 60s.
Okay. If there's anything I did not like in the UK, it's the class system. And it was emphasized in Edinburgh.
I was just wondering, too, if you coming from a postdoctoral appointment in Canada might have been an extra black mark against your, you know, someone who left the UK.
No, because... no, I think that was, I think, fair enough. They regarded this as valuable experience in another country. It wasn't, although the brain drain business was in full swing then, it certainly wasn't held against you. And there was no doubt that I got experience at NRC that I would not have got in the UK.
In this position, you were to teach?
To teach and do research, yeah.
And what teaching assignment did you get?
The teaching, every new lecturer was, as their first job, was given chemistry for engineers. And the engineers, being bloody engineers, didn't give a toss about chemistry. It was a hurdle they had to jump.
Right.
And so they, I have to say, if you did not have a sense of humour, they would destroy you. And the guy who came after me had to be relieved of the course at Christmas, because they were a right bloody lot. They knew they'd got to pass this course, but they may as well get as much entertainment out of it as possible. I'll give you two quick examples. One morning, a guy leaps up. It's a big class, about 50 or 60 students. A guy leaps up, blows a whistle in the middle of the lecture. Actually, it was exactly halfway through the lecture. He blew the whistle. The entire class on the right moved to the left, and all the class on the left moved to the right, because it was half time.
Oh.
And they produced oranges and started to suck the oranges. Well, you had to laugh. I mean, come on, that was quite a good wheeze. And there was another guy who was always late. And in those strange days, when you went to a lecture, there were gentlemen called servitors, dressed in fancy dress, who stood outside the corridors and took the names of the students as they came in, so that they had a class record.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, there was one student who was always late, and so I used to try and think up something new, some new little sarcasm for his late arrival, and it became a little interplay, you know. And one morning I noticed, oh, he's not there, he's probably going to come late. And about a quarter of an hour into the lecture, there was a huge thumping on the door. Oh, shit, who's this? So anyway, one of the students got up and opened the door. In comes this guy. He's in his pajamas with a dressing gown, a nightcap and a candle in a stick, and he shuffles in. So, and it went on like that. And anyway, I told them what would happen if they didn't pass the bloody course at Christmas at the end of the academic year. But on the whole, a reasonable liaison existed between us. But it was if you took it to heart, it would be awful.
Oh yeah,
it'd be
like
awful. That's right.
But I mean, these were engineers who weren't going to be chemical engineers.
That's right. No, they were going to be like mechanical or electrical or whatever. And chemistry was a hurdle they had to jump.
My.
Yes.
Boy. But I mean, you held the power of the grade over their head. Right?
Yes, that's right.
If they were clever enough, most of them could probably pass the...
Yes, it wasn't a demanding course. It was a great deal of inorganic chemistry, kind of chemistry that you expect an engineer to have some kind of knowledge of.
So this was more for entertainment than...
Well, it didn't feel entertaining at the time. At the time, you used to think, "Oh shit, it's engineers this morning." Oh,
so
yes.
Did you have other teaching assignments?
Yeah, physical chemistry, thermodynamics, and that's another hurdle for you to jump, to be asked to do thermodynamics.
Oh God, yes.
And I quickly discovered I'd pretty well forgotten what little thermodynamics I knew, and so I had to really work my socks off.
Yeah.
Because I discovered that the only way to teach thermodynamics is to state many of the ideas in as many possible equivalent ways as you can think of, because one of them will stick with the students. It's a desperate subject to teach.
Oh yeah, it is indeed. It's probably also one of the most feared things.
Yes. There's an American who wrote a book called The Second Law, a man called Henry Bent, and it's a book which I have kept, and it's about thermodynamics, of course, but it's a completely unconventional way of teaching thermodynamics. Brilliant book, Henry Bent. Wow, this saved my bacon on many an occasion.
John Finn had the same experience of having to teach thermodynamics.
Oh, yes.
And he came about it in a non-unconventional way and ended up writing a book Yeah. Thermodynamics. Yeah. So it's an interesting challenge intellectually to teach and to learn.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yeah.
It's I like the idea of that you posed and thinking about as many examples as possible.
Yeah. Yes.
To comprehend or understand things. Yes.
Yes. If you can explain entropy in six or seven different ways, you're halfway to getting them some kind of idea.
Yes.
And of course, Boltzmann always saves the day.
Yes. So was this the extent of your teaching then, those two courses, or did you have more?
No, that was, I taught two courses, so that was, 3 hours for the chemists. It's probably 6 hours a week. Oh, and a lab course.
Oh, boy.
We always had a lab course to do.
Uh-huh.
One afternoon, usually.
Hopefully you had no untoward experiences in that.
No.
So it took you, 2 years to figure out that this was...
That this was not right. This really wasn't going to work. And I knew of Keith Laidler from his work on thermal decompositions. And I also knew that he was at the University of Ottawa.
Uh-huh.
And I also knew that he was going to be at a conference in Cambridge that I was going to.
Oh, there you go.
And so I buttonholed him after breakfast one morning and introduced myself and said, might there be any possibility of a position at the University of Ottawa?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't suppose you ever met Keith Laidler?
No.
No, nice guy. Rather austere, but very friendly. And he said, send us your CV, John.
Mm-hmm.
And so we chatted on, and he said, send us your CV, I'll get back to you. And about a month later, I got offer of a job.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it.
Mm.
And immigration took 3 weeks.
Oh, boy.
You went to Glasgow, you had the medical and the interview all rolled into one. Paperwork was completed. It was ridiculously easy.
Mm-hmm.
Takes best part of a year now.
No, oh, really?
Takes the best part of a year.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have to produce a police chit then,
mm-hmm,
to show you hadn't from the local constabulary.
Right.
Yeah. So that was really quick and easy. So back to Ottawa.
Yeah. So now you're basically coming back to where you had been before.
Yeah.
And you had enough experience with this part of the country that you felt this was a good place, and you isolated some people.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And kind of get back into the swing of things.
Oh, had a lot of outdoors here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's outdoors like you wouldn't believe.
A lot of cold outdoors.
Yeah, well, that was fine, but it was outdoors, was skiing and skating and sailing and canoeing and hiking, and it was all on your doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
Skiing in Scotland was really a hell of a business. The chances are it would be raining when you got there anyway.
Yeah. So let's back up a little bit. When did your interest in all of this outdoors activity start? Is that
when you're a wee tiger. Oh, from childhood, I suppose. I was enchanted by my first bicycle.
Oh.
I suddenly realized that I could go anywhere.
Yeah.
And the same friend that I still see, Ken and I used to take our bicycles on the continent every summer, mm-hmm, till the money ran out. This is when we were just out of school. He was in college, I was at Glaxo, and then I was at University College and so on. He did his PhD at University College in, mm-hmm, chemical engineering. And so we went on the continent for 6 years in a row, and we went from the only countries... We went everywhere west of the Iron Curtain, the lot, from the very top of Norway to central Spain and to Italy, Switzerland, Germany, Denmark, the whole kit and caboodle, yes.
Mm.
And
all by
bicycle. And so, yeah, we went back this year, he and I, to the North Cape, right at the very top of Norway, which then was only accessible by boat. Now they built a tunnel under the fjord and you can get there by road. And yeah, the change is huge. It's now a tourist trap. Then you had to climb a 1,000-foot cliff from a little jetty at the water. But now there's a huge parking lot, cafeteria, cinema.
But then, so this was really like in your early teens, mid-teens?
No, it was in my 20s. This was some late teens and 20s was all the travel.
And basically, you say you just go until the money ran out.
We'd save up for our summer excursion in Europe, and we'd have an emergency return arranged, which was a provisional booking on a boat or a plane, and we would work it out. And if all went according to plan, we would manage about 6 weeks on the residuum from our research grants. And then come home again.
It was
the other thing which we did. We sailed together as well. We started sailing, and it was while I was at University College, the very first time I ever went to sea in a small boat. And so I've sailed the rest of my life.
So the Ottawa was attracted because of.
Because of the outdoor, the huge outdoors all the activity. And the university then, the chemistry department was small. Almost everybody was intensely interested in what they did. It was a very strong department with some extremely good people. And so you felt at home very quickly. The other wonderful thing was Keith had worked out an arrangement with NRC whereby NRC would build stuff for you. So you could toddle up to NRC and go down to the engineering shops and they'd say, "Hi, how are you?" They'd say, "Well, I got a little sketch here. I wonder if you could make one of these for me." "Ooh, yeah, what's it for?" I said, "Well, it's to do this related to a photochemical experiment." Say, yeah, "we'll give you a call when we've made it." It was super, absolutely super.
There's nothing like having a shot.
Needless to say, it doesn't remotely work today. Security, you'd have to show a pass to get past the front door.
The university is situated right next to NRC, is it?
No, well, we're here, and NRC is, a mile and a half away? So it was easy to drop in to see the glassblower or whatever. Then the university then was still a Catholic institution, and so there were crucifixes all over the classrooms and so on. Started out as a Catholic university, and then in 1964, it was run by the Oblate Order of. Catholic fathers. And in 64 it became a provincial university. The Oblates really couldn't afford it any longer, and so they backed out, and they've got a theological college still down in town. I liked the fathers. They were great. You had a problem, you picked up the phone, you said, Father Pierre, whoever, and you'd have a chat about the state of the local football team or the Montreal Canadiens, and he'd say, "What can I do for you?" And I can remember phoning down saying, "Listen, I'm planning to go to England for about a month in the summer next year, my entire vacation. Do you think I could have a month's salary in advance?" "Oh, yes, no problem at all. Send me a little note." And sure enough, your salary would have been paid in advance. Just by word of mouth and a little piece of paper. They were very, very flexible.
So were there very many of them actually teaching, or
only in the humanities. And every now and again, of course, in my second year of phys chem class, there'd be a couple of young trainee priests would come in, and they were here to learn about wicked old science. And they were usually very, very serious people. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to raise a smile out of them. So it became a provincial university, right. And
so that's the, in Canada, that's the equivalent of a state university.
That's equivalent of a state university, yes, okay. Yes. And research funding was quite easy.
Being close to NRC helped, or?
Yes, because NRC were the funding agency.
Yeah.
And they were it. It wasn't a separate branch of government. Mm-hmm. It was NRC's scientists who made the decisions. And so I think they were very fair, but I have to say, being in town rather helped. And so I always had, by present-day standards, a small operating grant. But it was never in peril, and besides, there was too much going on, too much fun. I had some very good first students, extraordinary, good young people.
So speaking of your career up to this point, is there any one or two individuals that you considered to be what I would call mentors, or someone who...
Oh, Alan McColl. Okay. Alan was
the primary mentor.
Yes, you could always go to Alan for advice about anything scientific or professional. He was a great friend. Otherwise, no, I don't think so. I made some quite good friends at Edinburgh, but I was impermanent. And did I learn very much at Edinburgh? No, there was another photochemist there, and I don't know. We never quite gelled. Sorry to go off at a tangent. I had a fun experiment in Edinburgh. In studying pyrolyses, one of the key questions is whether it's a molecular reaction or a free radical reaction. And there were tests which you applied to see if it was molecular or if it was free radical. And one of the tests was either to add an olefin, like propene, which is not a very good free radical trap, but never mind, or better still, nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is a great free radical trap, as you might guess, and so it will cut a chain reaction. And so the reaction, which went like smoke at this temperature and pressure in the presence of nitric oxide, practically bugger all happened because you'd broken the chain. And so the chain never established. Well, out of sheer curiosity at University College, I was doing sec propyl iodide, which I was confident was a molecular process, elimination of HI, the reaction of HI with the iodide, so you got propane, propene, and iodine as the products. And just because it was the done thing, I added nitric oxide. And it didn't seem to do much to the overall kinetics. The only problem was that in the trap that I used to condense out the products to get rid of them, a white solid appeared. This is silly, it must be a one-off, so you repeat the experiment, hey, more white solid. What the hell is this white solid? And it was ammonium iodide. So I figured that nitric oxide had reacted very rapidly with hydrogen iodide and been reduced all the way down to ammonia. And then, of course, it would, ammonium iodide is not very volatile. It would tend to come out on any cold surface. So I promised that when I got the time and opportunity, I'd do the kinetics of NO plus HI. And I did that at Edinburgh. And it was, wow. It was a pure second order reaction. NO plus HI equals HNO plus I. And the HNO then was reduced very rapidly by hydrogen iodide, all the way down to ammonia. And so the first reaction gave you the bond strength of HNO. So it was, it was a fun thing to do. You know, you have these little observations, and you think one day I'll follow it up and see what happened.
I put that in the category of the serendipity kind of thing.
Yes, you know, that's right.
Out that you never expected.
That's right.
Because this white stuff is there.
Yeah, what the hell is it?
And then serendipitous result.
That's right. Well, I would argue that the difference between a good scientist and a better scientist is the better scientist recognizes the luck when it happens, because all the exciting things have been luck and been some stupid thing which many people would say, oh, bugger that, it doesn't matter. It was really important.
I can't come bring to mind right now the situation where there's two or three different things that occurred that people, like you say, pushed aside and someone else looked at more intently and
that's
says,
right.
Whoa, you know.
Yes,
science isn't this linear thing that gets taught in textbooks.
It's what granting agencies want. Linear.
Yes, indeed.
When I was in East Germany and at the University of Leipzig, I got talking to graduate students. Their English was great. And they told me what they were doing. And I said, it sounds as if you're making good progress. And what are you going to do next? And to a man, he would say, we have the plan. So I'd say, well, what do you mean the plan? And he'd say, well, in year one, I will do this, and I am nearly complete. In year two, I will do this. In year three, I will do that. So I said, but science doesn't work like that. Said, what do you mean it doesn't work like that? This is the plan. This is the way our supervisor tells us we are going to do our research. But I said, supposing an exciting result occurs here. No. We must stick to the plan. And that was that very East Germany was East Germany then. And I thought, yes, this is a very totalitarian view of how science should be pursued.
Very well organized.
Yes.
It doesn't work that way.
No, it never has.
Do you want to take a break now? Or
Would you like a cup of coffee?
That would be good.
We can go in search of a cup of coffee.
All right, why don't I put this guy on?
I'm sorry, I do rabbit on.
No, this is good. Let's see, I've pushed the right button.
Outfit used to come to University College. And a representative of the Air Force and the Army would arrive in a big lecture theatre. And the Navy, of course, you couldn't do your national service in the Navy. You could only join the Navy. So anyway, these guys would come. And the Air Force fellows were usually had a slight sense of humour or could take a bit of banter. The army people were really silly stuffed shirts, they really were. Anyway, on this particular occasion, we were all duly assembled and the military had taken up their positions and all their bits of paper on the platform. And there was a rat-a-tat at the door. And in came the engineers and they all had big T-squares at the slope. And so they all came in and did a little drill with much stamping and shouting in front of the assembled military. And of course the army fellow was horrified, and the Air Force chap laughed, thought it was wonderful. Anyway, and the whole proceedings went that way. The students didn't give a monkeys about messing about in the forces for a couple of years, and wanted a way out of it. Mm-hmm. And at the end, the military people made quite reasonable presentations, but not holding out any brilliant prospects for the students. And at the end, the Air Force chap stood up and he looked around and he said, "Well, any questions?" And so, of course, the primed person at the back leapt up and said, "Yes, how can we get out of it?" Oh, dear.
I'd like for you to repeat, if you would, briefly, that little anecdote that you told about you in Edinburgh, talking to this prim and proper woman.
The Scottish historian. Yeah. Yes, it was one of those little parties for new members of staff, where you drink sherry and eat little things on sticks and are expected to mingle with the permanent staff. And I found myself talking to a little tweedy Scottish lady who told me she was a historian, and we chatted about this and that, and I told her about Canada, and she looked at me and said very cannily, she said, "You'll have private means, of course." The understanding being that as a poorly paid academic, I could not lead a proper life unless I had private means, which I suspect she probably had. It was assumed that any aspiring academic would have private means. Tom Cottrell had private means. I've spoken about Tom. Tom had married an admiral's daughter, and they were extremely well heeled, and it wasn't because Tom had had a super job with ICI either.
So it's a little bit, you know, there's this semi-soap opera we talked about, Downton Abbey.
The spectre of class raised its heads on so many occasions. When we first went to Edinburgh, I had to find somewhere to live. And so there used to be a big general store, mostly expensive clothing and furniture, down on Prince's Street called Janner's. And they had a housing unit, so I go to the housing unit, looking for a flat to rent at a fairly reasonable rate. And so we're given a list of addresses and off we toddled, and they were absolutely awful, awful, dingy, gloomy places. And the best of a bad lot was in a building made entirely of stone, a series of flats on different floors. This was a ground floor flat, and it is no exaggeration to say that the sun could not possibly shine in any of its windows. The coal was kept in a cupboard in the kitchen. You brought the coal in through the front door because it was coal heating. It was as cold as charity, but it was the best of a bad lot. Mm-hmm. We went back to Jenner's and said, "Well, with reluctance, we're going to take this one in Comerston Gardens, and really don't think very much of it." And the person leaned across the desk and said, "It's a very good address. It's a very good address," because it was in the area called Morningside. And somehow that typified the way things were.
But in real estate, it's location, location, location. Yeah. You know. Said we. Were you married?
I was married. Yes, that was my first wife. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So you were married somewhere in that period before you went to, before you came to Ottawa?
Yes, before coming to Ottawa. Yeah.
Okay. So let's see, we were
at the University of Ottawa, yeah, yes, yes, yeah. And we had to, all that help from NRC.
Yeah. Now, here again, you were obliged to teach courses.
Yes.
So what did you start with here?
Physical chemistry,
okay.
General physical chemistry, and of course the dreaded thermodynamics and dull things like electrochemistry. Mm-hmm. Anyway, general physical chemistry, and a course on kinetics, because Keith Laidler's claim to fame was his knowledge and expertise in thermal decompositions, mm-hmm. the kinetics and mechanisms of chain reactions and God knows what. Mm-hmm. He had done all the fundamental work on small hydrocarbons, aldehydes, ketones, mm-hmm. and so on, okay. and so the mechanisms were known. And yes, he had a very wide reputation. He wrote several books on chemical kinetics, he also wrote History of Physical Chemistry.
Oh, really?
Which is excellent book. Hmm. Excellent book.
I have to add it to my library.
Yeah, it's the only history of physical chemistry that I know of. Mm-hmm. And he covers all the classical periods of physical chemistry.
Laidler.
Keith K.J. Laidler. Laidler.
Did you get settled with one of these huge sections of organic chemistry that
No.
I mean, there's somebody taught, I mean, there was, did they have this tradition?
You have to remember it was really rather a new university then, particularly in terms of sciences. Mm-hmm. And so the undergraduate intake at first year was maybe between 100 and about 150 students.
Oh.
And so at the end of, on the top of the pyramid, the number of fourth year honours chemistry students was perhaps 10, 8. Mm-hmm. And all the others, of course, from first year had gone off into biology, mm-hmm. or whatever the mm-hmm. other sub-discipline.
So it was a fairly small school.
Yes, the second year of phys chem was a class of between 20 and 30. Then.
So you
knew the class. Mm-hmm. You got to know the beards and the girls by name first.
Yeah. And then the relationship with NRC probably was really good for the university, because it was
excellent, because they gave us free liquid nitrogen. Wow. Used to go and collect it in those big tip-up cans, mm-hmm. and as I say, they built equipment. I drew a design for a photochemical apparatus, took it up there. Yes, that'll take us about a month, and a big wooden box about 3x3x4, which had an optical bench and everything, so I could do all my external glassware, connect everything up. I had a complete system for doing organic photochemistry, kinetics.
So was this something for which you paid, or was this something that...
No. NRC made these things. It was grace and favor.
Oh, wow.
There was no payment involved. Those were happy times.
I can see that you prefer those times to these
times. It was very constructive, and it meant, of course, that the professorial staff at the university also contributed to NRC. Because the postdoctoral fellows would come to lectures or seminars at the university, and we would certainly go there, mm-hmm. and so it was a two-way flow of people.
A nice informal arrangement that you probably couldn't work out today if you wanted to.
Just say the word security, and you knocked it on the head almost immediately.
Oh, my.
It's
I noticed when we went between buildings, there was a lot of keys involved in unlocking all the doors and getting into various rooms and whatnot.
Yeah. Yes. Well, what can I say? In the old chemistry building is the next building over, and that was open to the street. Big front door was open to the street all day, and so every now and again, you would indeed find a shady-looking individual sloping down a corridor and peeping into offices, and a sharp word would send them scuttling, because there was a small amount of theft from offices. But we had a custodian as well who sat in the hall as a kind of gate guard, but he wasn't there all the time. Yeah. He had lunch break. But it was indeed a much more freewheeling kind of time.
Okay, so you finally graduated in industry. You didn't even, well, I guess being associated with the NRC was as close as you got to the government in terms of interacting.
Yes,
the NRC a government type operation, I guess.
It sure as hell is now. It wasn't then. It was entirely Stacy's doing. Stacy was a man who could speak to government with authority, and they listened to what he said. The small scientific component of the government used Stacy as an advisor. Mm-hmm. Stacy said, if we want to develop science, we've got to have a route for getting scientists to Canada. Mm-hmm. He said, I suggest postdoctoral fellowships. Mm-hmm. At Sussex Drive and out on the Montreal Road. And when I was at Sussex Drive, there were probably about 50 people in my age group from all over the world. And a significant sum of them stayed to become academics in Canada. So it was politically driven, but by a scientist, not by politicians.
But there was a desire by the Canadian government to promote science.
Yes, because science, it was reckoned that science had won the war, you see. Mm-hmm. Science could do no wrong for a period after the war. It was the way of the future. And so it was very popular, And I remember when I first came to Ottawa, the teaching of chemistry in the high schools here was great. And they'd come up, borrow stuff from us.
Oh.
And we'd go there taking liquid nitrogen and things so that we could do little demonstrations.
So you actually had interactions?
There was a lot of high school interests. That's mostly gone now.
Oh, okay. So how was this promoted? Was it through a formal program or informal?
Informally. You got to know people. Mm-hmm. And they said, can you come out and give a talk to the school? Yeah, when?
Sure.
And off you went.
And the high schools were promoting this, the teacher, this would be up to the teacher.
Yes. When I came, it was a funny thing, when I came to Ottawa, I discovered that had I instead chosen to be a high school teacher, I would have been paid rather better than I was here.
That's interesting.
Not anymore.
Well,
not anymore. No, high school teachers were regarded as significant members of the community. Was a good profession. Now, of course, they have very little authority left.
Did that come out of the Canadian worldview, or was it something left over from the UK, or the influence of the UK? How much influence relative to, say, the French and the English is there in this part of Canada?
That's quite difficult. You see, when I first came to Canada, this doesn't sound very nice, but French Canadians were regarded as the hewers of wood and the drawers of water. Mm-hmm. They were a peasant class. Mm-hmm. But there's a strong element of truth in that, because Quebec politics were to a great extent governed by the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
The Catholic Church was immensely powerful in Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 60s into 70s, they had what they called a quiet revolution. And all the old politicians were thrown out, and they became much, in many ways, as or more progressive than Canada, than the rest of the rest of the country. But then it was very backward looking, and
so I guess I'm not clear as to how the church influenced. I mean, they had politicians in place that
they had a major influence on every aspect of society. That's politics, law, education.
Ah, okay.
And so, to a great extent, they controlled what went on.
Mm-hmm.
But this had to end. That was too far, too backward looking. It was a very, very conservative, large C conservative.
Okay, so education of the French Canadians so was not considered to be an important.
Oh, well, it was, provided they towed the religious party line. Mm-hmm. It was extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that struck me in Canada, in Ottawa, sitting and having coffee or lunch with the guys at NRC, and you listen to the Canadians talking, and they all knew what everybody else's religious denomination was. You know, you'd hear, so-and-so's son, oh, gosh, he's going out with a Catholic girl, oh, my God. And then it was, oh, shock, horror. And this is something that I had never encountered in the UK. But everybody knew what it was. Yes, oh, God, what? Oh, she's a Methodist. What? You can't have your boy going out with a Methodist. And this, the aspect of religious interference in personal life was quite strong.
Yeah.
It's,
that's interesting.
But that's, needless to say, that doesn't hold much.
Yeah, well, I think it was that way in the States for some time. I know when where my father and mother got married in Laredo, Texas, he was a Southern Baptist and she was a Catholic, and that was anathema.
Wow, gosh, wow. Gosh, hellfire for both of them.
Exactly.
oh, dear.
So you started out doing more photochemistry when you got
here? Yeah, I wanted to do hydrogen atom reactions, and it seemed that quite a good way of producing hydrogen atoms with different temperatures was to photolyze hydrogen iodide at different wavelengths, and also to employ a method where you thermalize the hydrogen atoms by having a great density of inert gas atoms.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a lot of kinetics of hydrogen atom reactions with substrates of one sort or another. And then
what happens to the iodide when you do this hydrogen iodide photolysis experiment?
It usually almost invariably ends up as iodine.
Mostly
ends up as iodine.
So you get your hydrogen atom.
Yeah.
But so why does it want to go back to H2?
That's a
molecule. I mean, my chemistry here is pretty weak, you can see. But.
There's a bit of background here. In all the physical chemistry textbooks, it was believed that the perfect example of a second-order bimolecular reaction was HI plus HI equals H2 plus I2. And a guy called Sullivan in the States did a very clever piece of photochemistry where he showed, I'm awfully sorry, physical chemistry for the last 40 years, it involves atoms and not molecules. And so, shock. So one of the reactions which about which the kinetics were not terribly well known was the reaction of hydrogen atoms with iodine itself. And so that was part of my photochemical interest, was to finish up. Did two or three papers about hydrogen iodide photolysis. And also I carried on with thermal decompositions in the Alan McColl sense. Sorry to go into detail, but one of the problems is if you do a static pyrolysis of an organic compound in a glass or quartz reaction vessel, there will be surface catalyzed processes until the surface has been essentially squished by the deposition of polymer, really, hydrocarbon polymer.
Sure.
And so treating the surface of a reaction vessel before attempting pyrolysis was a key experiment. Now the recipe for treating the surface was to pyrolyze in the system, pre-pyrolyze, allyl bromide. And that produces a carbonaceous film, which after several treatments is just visible. The glass becomes a bit translucent as you deposit carbon. And a question which had been raised was, yeah, that's all very well. We can see from the kinetics and all the packed vessel experiments that it's all homogeneous and so on. And once you've treated the surface, but what is this surface? So the argument was that the surface should contain free radicals. And so friend at NRC said, why don't you make some of this carbon, bring it down to the ESR lab, and we'll have a look.
Sure.
And so, right, so I made pyrolytic carbon samples and trotted them down to NRC, and sure enough, hey, look, big signal, free electrons in the surface material. Oh, so, Perkin Elmer, I think in those days, sold or had available a benchtop ESR apparatus.
Wow.
Not particularly sensitive, but very workmanlike, and would give you spectra. And I hadn't got $5,000 or $6,000 lying about, and I wasn't going to get it in a hurry. It's a lot of money then. You've got to multiply by probably a factor of 20 at least. Anyway, so I buttonholed the Perkin Elmer man when he came through, and I said, how about a rental? Could I rent an ESR machine from you for a year? I said, I'm sure I can get enough work done in a year to perhaps raise a grant for having one of my own. And he said, yes, no problem at all. He said, write to me, give an outline of what you want to do. So, yeah, right. Bang, away we go. And he phoned me and said, yes, he said, I think it's going to fly, and we'll have a machine to you next month.
And
management said, what's this? You're going to rent out one of these instruments? You should be selling it, not renting it out.
No.
And so so that died, which was pissed me off. I had a whole planned series of experiments to do to see what happened when you admitted different materials to the, anyway, so bugger that. But at the same time, at a staff meeting, Keith came in one day, smiling from ear to ear, and he said, right, he said, we've got $55,000 to go out and get our first mass spectrometer. He said, I need somebody to volunteer to be responsible for this, because I don't think anybody here knows anything about mass spectrometers, but he said, I need somebody to go and do it. There was a silence. So I thought about it, and I thought, well, I'll do it. I'll do it. So Keith said, right, off you go and see Fred Lossing. And talk to Fred Lossing. I believe they're interested in getting an instrument as well. So you go and have a chat with Fred and see what can be done. So I went up and saw Fred, who I hadn't seen for quite a long time. And he said, oh, yeah, John, great. I'm going down to Norwalk to Perkin Elmer, where they are the agents for Hitachi. And he said, I've heard good things about the Hitachi instruments. We'll make a plan and we'll fly down. So we went down to Norwalk, to the Perkinelma place, spent a couple of days there. I thought, well, Christ, this is a big piece of instrumentation, all pumps and meters and God knows what all. I expect I could manage it. And so Fred put it through its motions, and he liked what he saw, and he said, this is a well-designed piece of equipment. He said, I have no hesitation that NRC should buy this for all its future analytical mass spectrometry needs. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, yeah, far be it for me to say other. We'll do it. We'll go for it. So two RMU-6Ds came to Ottawa. It was the RMU-6D. It's a single-focusing analytical mass spectrometer with a mass range of maybe 1,000. Mm-hmm. And
EI source.
Yeah. And I was it. So Keith said, you better go and see the dean and arrange accommodation. So we negotiated a room for it in the old chemistry building. And of course the room was cleaned and cleared out and extra power brought in. And one day, hey, the guys arrive with crates and they assembled it. And a representative from Perkinelma gave me a quick run through, and he said, here are the manuals. So, and away you go.
This was
1964, I think.
Okay.
64. Anyway, yeah, about then.
In that range.
In that range. And so I shut the door and played with it for a while till I felt I'd got some idea what the hell was going on. And then I opened the manual. The manual had been written by the Japanese. And it was in pidgin English, and I can quote from it. It said, when loudly the pump gargles, do not begin the high vacuum. So that was the tenor of its production. And so I hung my shingle outside the lab and said, 1 or 2 days a week, I'll be available to the organic chemists to run mass spectra for you. And so, of course, there were synthetic guys upstairs who came flooding in. I said, no, hang on. I can only do so many samples, gases preferably.
Yeah.
Solids, if the solids probe was an ingenious bloody device on that thing. It was a turret, a rotatable turret. Yeah, it was a rotatable turret, so one probe was sticking vertically up. I have to find a picture somewhere. You rotated the turret and the probe would go in. The other probe, the companion probe, was now vertical and ready for a new sample. It was a clever device.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a nice rotatable turret, and so you could put your solid samples in. And the organic chemists were, of first they were delighted, and then they were really pissed off, because sometimes they would come down, they'd say, right, we've got this sterol, and by this reaction, that reaction, and so on with the double bond, we should have three more methyl groups in it.
Mm-hmm.
Run it through. Oh, sorry, you've got four methyl groups in. Mm-hmm. They say, no, that can't be possible. I'm sorry, look, there's a molecular iron, and it's 14 mass units up. It means you've got another. Don't believe it. So NMR, of course, was in a fairly infant stage then. And they'd go away and they'd come back looking crestfallen, and so, oh dear, it was confirmed by NMR. So I said, yeah, exactly, it was confirmed by NMR, because mass spec showed you unequivocally that your synthesis had overshot.
Yeah.
And
so you got to do this instead of ESR.
No, well, I did that instead of ESR. Yes, and I thought this is really a chore, and I asked if possibly we could have some youngster in who would run some of the samples, and I got a part-time assistant, because servicing the thing was an absolute bugger. Because it was all old-fashioned electronics, and the voltages carried by the condensers were not to be laughed at. Mm-hmm. You had to remember to ground everything in sight before you put your hand in. I got some nasty burns.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
There were glass blowing as well. The inlets, as the iron source was held in place through glass blowing. I wasn't a bad glass blower, mm-hmm. but there was a long graded seal going into the source, and I used to have to call the glass blower and say, "I don't think I can tackle that." He said, "Go on, have a go." So I broke it hot rod and mm-hmm. took it apart. And he said, "I think that's going to be quite difficult to join again." Mm-hmm. "I'll do it." So there was a glass blower involved whenever the filament had to be changed. Oh, yes. You had to do all this caper.
Yeah.
So it was a good machine. You know what the best feature, what's never been repeated? The iron source. The iron source, the usual box. The sample inlet was from the back of the box. That's out into the flight tube. And on either side, you had a pair of repeller plates.
Mm-hmm.
Two repeller plates.
Mm-hmm.
So you, by putting voltages on each plate, you could focus the beam. And also, you could change the residence time of the ions in the source.
Oh.
And that was, I thought that was fabulous. I thought, hey, this is not a bad physical chemistry machine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for about 2 years, I was burdened by this beastly machine.
Mm.
A friend at Reading University in the UK sent me a sample. He said, the mass spectrometer at Reading hardly ever works. And he said, "I got fed up with waiting. Is it all right if I send you a sample?" He said, "I think it's fumaric acid."
Mm-hmm.
That's the trans ethylene dicarboxylic acid. And so a little sample duly arrived through the post. I don't know if you could do it now. Anyway, mm-hmm. sample came. And I ran it, and indeed, it was fumaric acid. And so I looked in the book of spectra, and sure enough, there was a spectrum of fumaric acid. But the mass spectrum of maleic acid, the cis isomer, was reported as having no molecular iron.
Hmm.
I thought, well, that's peculiar. I wonder if we've got any maleic acid in the building, and we had. So I ran it. And there was a molecular iron. So I thought, oh, well, I can guess why it didn't work. The inlet system on Joe Blow's mass spectrometer was too hot, and it either dehydrated or decarboxylated or whatever. So anyway, the cis and trans isomers of ethene dicarboxylic acid do their own thing, absolutely. So rotation about the double bond in the iron is a non-starter. And I thought, that's nice. It's an explicit piece of mechanistic iron chemistry. And that was it. I was hooked. So I had a student. I said, "We're going to run a lot of carboxylic acids and see how the carboxyl groups interact." So we buy in a whole slew of compounds and run them through. Yeah, look, we can make sense out of this. All related geometry, molecular geometry in the neutral state, and so on. The whole thing just started from there.
So who was your friend at Reading?
It's Neil Isaacs. Is his name Neil Isaacs, I-S-A-A-C-S, Neil Isaacs.
So he got you...
He was a friend from NRC days.
But he kind of got you pointed in this whole
thing. And it was a sort of mechanistic, what the hell's going on here?
Up till then you were just kind of like running samples.
Up till then I was dog's body, keeping the bloody thing running and doing samples. Yeah.
So did you have most of the labs at that time had a tube tester so you could check your tubes and whatnot?
That's right.
Were you able to bring in an engineer to look at the machine at any time, or was it just
we had a major breakdown, electronic breakdown, And the local electronics guy said, I don't think I ought to meddle with that. So I phoned Norwalk and said, listen, I've not bothered you before.
Yeah.
Can you send an engineer? And they told me what the cost would be and so on. I said, well, go and see the chairman. Hey, can we afford this? And a guy came up from Perkin Elmer and he was useless. Oh. I knew far more than him, so I kicked him out. I kicked him out and I phoned and wrote a really sharp letter to Perkin Elmer saying, you know, wow. I sent it to the chairman of the company. Do you know who that was? It was Nimitz.
Oh.
Admiral Nimitz. So anyway, I was really furious because this guy had come up from Norwalk and he obviously didn't know anything. So we fixed it ourselves.
Oh, wow.
So,
and I guess you didn't have to pay for
it. It was a blowout of resistors in a resistor chain. So, yes, so it was a long, laborious business, you know, component by component.
As
it was in those non-solid state days.
But you had schematics, right?
We had circuit diagrams, and we had a proper tube tester and all the necessary AVO meters. And,
yes, those were fun. Nice. So what kind of recording device?
Visicorder.
Visicorder,
yes.
So that was that.
Yes, it was good Visicorder. It wasn't the kind you had to immerse in a solution.
No.
It was just the paper, the optical paper.
Yes. Did you ever run these experiments where you had to spit out paper at 50 feet per second or something?
Yes, that's right.
To make sure that you didn't stand too close.
No.
Hit by a sheet of paper.
Didn't stop it in time, yes.
This was a magnetic scanning?
Magnetic scan, yes. It just had an electromagnet. And the
60, 90, 180, what was, you recall the sector?
The angle, the sector angle.
You can probably find that in the literature.
I would think it more like 60.
I think
it's about far more like 60 than 90. I don't remember the flight tube going through a complete
And yes. Did it have a Faraday cage cup detector, or did it have electron multiplier on the detection?
Oh, electron multiplier. Yes. And I learned from Fred Lussing how to resuscitate your electron multiplier. You took it out. You put it into a large glass tube and you evacuated the tube, and then you filled the tube with a reasonable pressure of oxygen and you stuck it in the oven for about 300-400, and took it out, cut it open, and yes, it got about 50% of its original gain back. But its slope, it didn't last very long. But you would get several more months out of a multiplier by doing that.
Now, obviously you had to replace the filament, but what about cleaning the iron source? Was that an issue?
No, it was just a fiddly job.
No.
It was just a fiddly job. Cleaning all the and making filaments was also a bit of a challenge. With thoriated tungsten and spot welding them onto the mounts. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Those were the days.
So once you discovered this exciting bit of chemistry, you became more of a mass spec.
Well, I went to start reading the books then. I had a copy of Fred McLafferty's Interpretation of Mass Spectra.
Mm-hmm.
The little original paperback book, and I read this from cover to cover and thought, yes, we don't really know much about this mass spectrometry game, but there's a huge wealth of chemistry lurking in there, waiting to come out.
Uh-huh.
And I think about this time, Cy Myerson and I think John Bynum and his group had started doing isotopic labelling.
Okay.
And showing, for example, that in many small hydrocarbon ions, the carbon and hydrogen atoms lose their positional identity mm-hmm. before fragmentation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, benzene is the key example. I've forgotten who it was. It might have been Psi. But somebody made benzene with carbon 13 atoms in the para position mm-hmm. and showed that the acetylene that was lost was scrambled. Mm-hmm. So obviously, benzene, before it reaches its dissociation limit, does a huge amount of unknown chemistry. Mm-hmm. So the atoms all get scrambled. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, well, isotopic labeling, let's find out how to do it. And I had a graduate student then, who's still in town, actually, who was a synthetic whiz.
Oh, boy.
He was... It always worked. His name is Raj Kapoor, C-A-P-O-O-R. And we called him Captain Chemistry. I used to give him dreadful molecules to make. I'd say, listen, can you do me spiropentane with four deuteriums on one side of the spiral? No problem, says Raj. And a couple of weeks later, he'd bring in the sample with the NMR and everything. I was like, wow, how did you do that? Well, I reacted this with this, and so reduced that with, gosh, wow.
A good man to know.
And then Neil in England, we'd corresponded a lot about the maleic fumaric story. Uh-huh. And do you remember the Nor-Bornel excitements?
I remember
about the non-classical and classical ions. It was a great topic in solution chemistry.
Okay.
And so I got Neil to make us a sample of XO2 Nor-Bornel chloride with carbon 13 at a particular position. And Neil made it starting from carbon 13 CO2.
Oh, God.
Which is, wow. Yes, he was a pretty good chemist. Yeah. So we completed that little project together.
So this guy that got you kind of hooked on mass spec, you continued to collaborate with him?
No, only when something of mutual interest arose. And it so happened that the Nor-Bornel cation was one of these solution controversy things. Mm-hmm. Some Americans got very upset with their rival pictures. And we thought we'd have a look at what the corresponding gas phase ions did. Uh-huh. And being gas phase ions, of course, not solution ions, they had all their own personal chemistries to play with. Then it became obvious that the only way we were ever going to interpret mass spectra was to find out what the structures of the ions were. Mm-hmm. And that's when I went and had a chat with Fred Lossing, because I could see that if you could measure the energetics accurately, you could get heats of formation, mm-hmm. which would be structure characteristic. Mm-hmm. And out of the blue, I went up to see Fred, and we had a chat, and he said, what are you working on now? So I've got a little project going on with nitro aromatics. It was a little offshoot story. Mm-hmm. And he said, you're doing what? Mm-hmm. I said, we're doing whatever it was, nitrocarboxylic acids or something. And he said, son of a gun, that's what we're doing here. Mm. So I said, right, Fred, this has got to stop. We must communicate better in future. And so our collaboration began from that. And he started measuring on a appearance energies mm-hmm. for us, mm-hmm. and it all suddenly came together, because at that time, when we were just sort of pulling it all together here as where to go and what to do with mm-hmm. mass spectrometry, I went to the triennial meeting in Edinburgh, mm-hmm. and at the dinner, which was a dreadful drunk. I've never seen anything like it.
Oh, really?
The bottles of whiskey down the table. Well, yes. Anyway, sitting opposite me was a man called Jeff Dijkstra, a Dutchman. D-I-J-K-S-T-R-A, Jeff Dijkstra. Jeff Dijkstra. Anyway, Jeff said, I've got a young scientist who's just started working in my laboratory as a lecturer position, mm-hmm. and his master's degree and his PhD were on analytical mass spectrometry, and he said, could he come and spend a year with you? I said, yeah, sure, I'm glad to have him. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Holland and met Hans. This is Hans Terlouw, T-E-R-L-O-U-W. T-E-R-L-O-U-W, mm-hmm. Hans, and we got on very well, and he came to Canada for a year, and he's been a catalyst ever since. He's retired now from, he's at McMaster.
Oh, okay.
He came to Canada in about 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, and took a position at Mac. Mm-hmm. And we collaborated for years, because of funding difficulties in Canada, I used to go to Holland to carry out experiments.
Oh,
and so I would go for 3-month chunks, and Hans didn't have great number of teaching duties, and he had some good grad students, and we would have a whale of a time.
Mm-hmm.
He had technical support through one of his students, who is here now and works in the mass spec lab downstairs. Mm-hmm. He did a PhD with me and Hans, and his name is Mommers, M-O-M-M-E-R-S.
Mm-hmm.
And what Sander doesn't know about mass spectrometers and worth knowing, and so he built stuff for us from scratch, and whenever we thought of Hans and I thought of a new experiment, we'd make a little sketch and talk it over with Sander, and he'd say, yeah, we can make that, what we need is, and we'd assemble the components and he'd put it all together and we'd have a new piece of equipment for doing something, strange, like field ionizing neutrals and all sorts of, completely different experiments.
Yeah. So when you went to the triennial meeting, you met Dijkstra, who then got you in touch
with Hans Terlouw, and he came and spent a year.
And this would have been in the late 60s, early 70s?
This was 1972-ish.
Okay, the mass spec had been here long enough that it was no longer a novelty.
That's right, and by then we had just got an MS-902, an AEI apparatus.
Yes.
I had applied for a high-resolution apparatus,
mm-hmm.
Through the granting agency, and the department now believed that mass spectrometry was some use to organic chemists, and so there was a lot of support in the department. And we were interested in particularly in metastable ions.
Okay.
And so with an MS-902, you could defocus metastable ions and do MI scans and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so so we got the money, and I phoned the AEI representative in Canada and said, oh, great, we'll set up a visit for you in Manchester to go. You can go to Manchester and you can play with an MS-9 and see what it'll do for you. So I said, that's very nice. I said, I'm also going to Mass Annalen Technique in Bremen as an addition to the journey. So he said, oh, never mind, come along. And so the trip was arranged, and I arrived in Manchester. I went to the hotel. And to my horror, there was the Canadian representative standing in the entranceway of the hotel. And he said, "Oh, hi, John." He said, "I don't know how to tell you this." He said, "Well, I have to tell you." He said, "The instrument that you were going to have for yourself tomorrow has been sold, and it's gone." I said, "I've come 3,000 miles for this."
Yeah.
I said, "What's going on here?" So he said, "Well, you know, nothing to do with me. The sale was made, and it was dismantled yesterday." So, shit, that wasn't very good.
No.
So I went and spent a day with AEI, who, that was an education, because they had a separate walled-off glass-enclosed area with Hitachi computerized milling machines, high-precision machines, and they were just learning how to use them. And out in the general area were all these men in long brown coats diligently micro-machining on lathes to a huge degree of precision. I mean, AEI equipment then, you could take any component off any of them and it would fit. It doesn't work like that anymore. So anyway, so that was impressive. And then I went to Matt in Bremen. And I'm afraid the contrast was terrible, because I was met at the airport and taken to the factory, and it was all heel clicking and, "Yeah, we have this ready for you now. Come to the laboratory." And so immediately people were hurrying round, demonstrating this, demonstrating that. Then to the next laboratory. This is an alternative apparatus. It was a superb display. And I don't know if you remember this. Do you remember how the slits were adjusted? They were spring-loaded slits, which were held apart by a wire. And the wire was heated electrically so that its expansion allowed the slits to close by tiny degrees. That was very clever, but difficult to service. Anyway, so I was very impressed with Matt. But in the end, I bought an MS-902. So we had an MS-902, and it was installed here. I've got some pictures somewhere, because the vibes of the building were unsatisfactory for an MS-902. So they said, "You're going to have to insulate it from the building." And so we cut a hole in the floor, which was about, 10 by 5. And set up a steel tray on the beams, on the building beams, separated from them by double inflatable donuts. You've probably seen these. You fill the whole damn thing with cement and supporting rods, then you put your mass spectrometer down on the top. And the whole rig has a characteristic frequency of about 2 per second. And that's fine for high resolution. And the AEI guy, Ernie Mills, came and installed it. And he said, come and have a look. And he said, "Look, dynamic resolution, 170,000. "Wow, so 170,000. The spec was 120,000. Yeah. So it is 170,000. Yeah. Well, that's brilliant. But of course, that lasts for about 1 week.
Oh, yeah,
that
long.
Yeah.
I was wondering, when you were in the UK, was Brian Green there at that time? Or do you remember Brian Green?
No, because...
He was still with some other outfit.
He was, I think they were in the stages of thinking about or setting up VG.
Ah, okay.
You see? Yes. And then VG quickly became by far the best company. Wonderfully inventive.
Mm-hmm.
I like the VG people. John Race, did you ever meet John Race? And
yeah.
who was the technical guy? Oh, come on.
Bob Bateman.
Bob Bateman, yes. Ah.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember this. Michael Gross had an instrument built specially, and it had a great tin lid because it had a Mattock Herzog or something arrangement. Mm-hmm. It had a great tin lid like a tureen top. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this was being set up, and I remember Bob Bateman phoned. He said, "John, are you going to be in the UK in the next little while?" I said, "Well, I could be." Yeah. He said, "Well, if you like to come up for a couple of days, you can come and have a go on Mike's new instrument." So I was obviously thinking of selling me one. Yeah. So I took them up on that, and I had 2 days of playing on their thing. But that was VG, and that was by present day standards, this was not good company policy. VG were completely free. There were no secrets. If they designed something for you, they didn't care who you told about it. We have a patent with VG for the radiative emission from iron beams.
Yeah,
and they were super. Now, of course, it's Waters, and it's a whole different ball game.
Yeah, I was pretty much disappointed to see VG getting taken over by the corporate culture thing.
But you know who they originally belonged to? They were financed by an insurance company.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Their initial backing was from a British insurance company.
I remember Jerry Kearns was, with VG. He was, I think at the time I was at McDonnell Douglas, and we were thinking about buying a machine, and Jerry was kind of like the big man that would come in and
try to
put the pressure on you and make a decision. And I went to the ASMS meeting in Florida at that time, or one of the early ones, and he had just moved from AI to VG. You know, it was like a, you know,
it's a whole new world. Yes. Oh, visiting VG was always a pleasure because they always grab you and say, "Hey, look, we're developing this. Let's show you how it works." And AEI were completely secretive. I remember saying, "What's that mass spectrometer over there?" Well, that's a new development. It was a rather useless thing that came after the MS-9.
They did something with a variable. Shaped magnet.
Yeah, what the hell was it called? Oh, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But anyway, but they were secretive about it. As VG would have said, come and see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you ended up with this MS-902 in, did you actually, how much of the higher resolving power capability of the instrument did you end up using in your science, in your research? Was it really that?
Hans and I did metastable ions with the MS-902 because you could separate the metastable peaks under high resolution and run their shape.
Okay, so this is an EB machine, right?
This is electric sector and then magnetic sector.
Yeah.
So you'd have to use the accelerating voltage scan method. And so this is still tube.
Yeah.
This is still tube stuff.
Yeah.
So we got the electronics technician that we had here to build a motor-driven scanner.
Oh, there you go.
And it was driven by motor, and it scanned the accelerating voltage very slowly and incrementally, and it had a big meter, big digital meter.
Mm.
So for want of a better argument, you could set it at X volts, and over a period of 1 minute, 2 minutes, it would scan to X plus 20 volts, and so your metastable peak would come out in huge detail on your trace, with all the characteristics of the kinetic energy release hidden inside the signal, and so. Hans came, hey, what should we do? So I said, well, let's look around for some simple isomeric ions and see if they interchange before dissociation or whether they do their own thing.
Okay.
And by sheer happenstance, we chose acetaldehyde vinyl alcohol and oxirane or ethylene oxide. Mm-hmm. That's the three C2H4O isomers mm-hmm. that you can get in a bottle mm-hmm. or out of a cylinder. Mm-hmm. And making vinyl alcohol is not difficult, mm-hmm. vinyl alcohol ions.
So these were basically the same
C2H4O. And they were completely different in their dissociation characteristics with regard to the loss of a hydrogen atom. And so the three signals were completely different. I mean, really completely different. One was like this. Mm-hmm. One was like this. Mm-hmm. And the other one was like that. So we say, hey, yes, look, we've explicitly identified these three alternative structures for this ion. Let's expand the whole story further. So we, of course, ran around looking for molecules which would fly, and some did and some didn't. And I guess after, I suppose, 2 or 3 years' work, we reckoned that this was a limited technique mm-hmm. Because so many gas phase ions lose their initial structure before they dissociate. And so as a structure probe, looking at the dissociating ions was not a very good idea. Uh-huh. It was too late in their life story. And about this time, Fred McLafferty, I'll tell you this, I think it's a great way of thinking about science. There were two reports in the literature. They came out within a month of each other in different journals. Mm-hmm. One of them said, effectively, if you've got a double focusing mass spectrometer, and there's a bit of a leak in your flight tube, which you don't normally monitor, you've got a lot of spurious signals. And that's due to the ions being collisionally dissociated. Mm-hmm. So listen up, you guys. If you get all this rubbish, clamp all the things down. And Fred McLafferty saw this, and he thought, maybe there's some information mm-hmm. in this. And he said, crack the thingies in your flight tube and let a little air in and see if you can make use of the information. That's collision-induced dissociation. But the two reports side by side, you see, one got it, the other guy said, oh, well, here's an interesting phenomenon. Yes, I won't tell you who the other guy was, but anyway, I thought, yes, that's exactly... So, needless to say, we couldn't do collision-induced dissociation with an MS9. Mm-hmm. And so Hans had returned to Holland. We'd collaborated for a couple of years, and he got promoted. He got kicked upstairs. Hooray! And he also got money, a lot of money, for a ZAB.
Oh, okay.
And the ZAB was new then. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, it's a reverse geometry instrument, right. And it can do everything the proper way round, where you select your ion of interest and then perform experiments on it. And so I applied here for a ZAB, and the guys who came to do the review were both synthetic organic chemists, and I have to say they didn't know what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. So I got turned down. Mm-hmm. And I was understandably quite pissed off by this. Yeah. A few letters exchanged hands. Mm-hmm. And the next time, but it was a year after, yeah. They sent another committee. There were people who knew what I was talking about. Mm-hmm. But for a couple of years, I used to go to Holland to do experiments on mm-hmm. Hans's machine. Mm-hmm. And with Sander, who is now here, Mommers. He was there, and so we made additional devices to go inside. Mm-hmm. And then I got my own ZAB downstairs. In fact, we did better than that, because it was suggested, We've got another university in Ottawa. It's Carleton University.
Okay.
And Carleton University, not off the record, is not a very strong chemistry department, but they needed mass spectrometry. Mm-hmm. And I visited them and said, listen, I'd like to perhaps make a big grant application. We'll get more than one mass spectrometer. You guys will have access to mass spectrometry service. And I went up to NRC, where they were not expanding mass spectrometry, and said to Fred, listen, we would be prepared, because Fred hated doing analytical stuff, wasn't his bag. I said, listen, we will take all NRC's ordinary analytical mass spectrometry if you'll come out on our side to make our lab more instrument rich. Mm-hmm. And so yeah, it was wonderful. NRC coughed up money. Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council, which is the government body, kicked up money. This university, NRC and Carleton, gave us operating funds, because it's no good having the apparatus if you can't afford to run it. And absolutely wonderful. So we were off and running, and we had everything we could possibly need. And I had a technician who's just retired, who did all the routine analytical work. Mm-hmm. He was an absolute crackerjack at analytical chemistry.
He was.
His name is Kazakov. He's of Russian descent, comes from Saskatchewan. His name is Clem, C-L-E-M, Kazakov, K-A-Z-A, K-O-F-F.
K-O-F-F,
Kazakov. And he retired a couple of years back. So we had a unit which, well, provided service work and could do research as well.
Mm-hmm. So this was the ZAB instrument?
This was the ZAB and a 7070. The 7070.
Oh, okay. So you got
the 7070 as well to
so
do the routine, to do the analytical work.
Okay.
The ZAB was only a research instrument.
Yeah, so the ZAB was reverse geometry, but the 7070 is forward? Or
the 7070 is forward, yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah. But you could buy it with reverse geometry.
Oh, really? Okay.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember, Hitachi did a double focusing instrument, not the H2, and called an RMU7, which was the same size as the 6D, but with an electric sector. And you've got to hand it to Hitachi. Hitachi produced it as an EB apparatus, but it didn't matter. You could take the B and put it before the E, and it all joined together. It all worked.
Mechanically. Wow.
So a friend in Montreal that I collaborated with had a 7, and he said, "Gosh, I should reverse the geometry," and he did, and yep, no problem. Vacuum came down. Everything worked.
That's nice.
Versatile.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So, is Hitachi in the mass spec business anymore? We've got GLO.
The big double focusing instrument that Fred McLafferty had, RMH2. At the time I put in for the ZAB, I asked Hitachi if they would make me an RMH2 and how much.
Mm-hmm.
And they sort of might, but they didn't show the right kind of interest.
They weren't enthusiastic.
Yeah. No. But it's a pity, because that was a fine instrument as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. All those wonderful old things and wonderful different things. So what did you want to...
Should we have a break?
Let's take a break for food.
There's a calf over the road, which is